Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom. And in our continuing John's leave of absence, I've got a good friend of the show and a good friend of John's and now a good friend of mine who has been on the show before, Charlie. What's up, Charlie?
Hey, how's it going? What's up, Tom?
So for those of you who may not remember, Charlie served in the Marine Corps and had a pretty fucking cool job blowing shit up and or making sure people didn't get blown up, I guess might be a better way to say it, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we did roll with 1,750 pounds of C4 in the back for our Amtrak's. But
yeah, so fighting fire with fire, you were fighting explosives with explosives.
Too much.
And then Charlie also works for a Southern California law enforcement agency that shall remain nameless unless he wants to name it, which I wouldn't.
No, probably not.
Right. How you been?
Good. Just been remodeling the house and working out and working.
Ah, so headed remodeling the house. In other words, headed to divorce.
I really hope not.
Right. That's one of the hardest things to go through when you're married is to remodel. Man.
Yes. It's been very, very interesting and very rough, but I got to give kudos to her because she's been doing all the stuff I don't want to do and getting into the positions that I necessarily can't get because I can't get under our sink.
Right. Yeah. You're a little too wide.
Just a little bit.
And not in a bad way. You're like yoked.
No, I got stung by a bee, but puffy. Been painting and stuff like that and doing all the tape jobs. And
it's the honey-do list.
I don't want to do any of that.
It's the honey-do list, man.
Yeah, so, she's doing it.
And if she's that, marry you that. Oh, wait, you did marry that girl. You find a girl like that that's willing to do like mudding and taping and painting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep her.
Good one to lock down. Yeah.
But you brought us a guest this week. And it's Brian. Hey, Brian, how are you?
Good.
And this represents a unique moment in our show because Brian spent 4 years with the Marine Corps and then 28 years with CHP and then 4 years as a deputy chief at Shafter PD. Is that correct?
Yeah, right.
So this is proof that as much as we give each other shit, we are all on the same side because anybody that listens to this show knows we give school resource officers shit, and yet we've had school resource officers on the show, and we give CHP officers shit, and we now have a CHP officer on the show.
So your show just like leaped, you know, bounds. I mean,
yeah,
now you're with the elite. See?
Yeah, so we're interviewing someone who worked for the premier law enforcement agency in California.
In
the world, right. Or so I'm told. I did watch Chips as a kid.
And
that was a big influence on me. And I actually took a DUI course from, if you remember the opening credits, the close-up shot of the guy shifting the gear shift on the bike. It was a sergeant with CHP. That was his foot. And his name's Gordon Graham. I'm sure you're aware. And
every law enforcement officer in California and the country knows Gordon Graham. I worked with him in Central LA.
I was going to say, I'm sure you're aware, and I would be willing to bet you worked with him. And yeah. I remember being in a DUI class with the famous Gordon Graham,
and him telling the story about how that was his foot on the introduction to chips, you know? And so then I'm sitting there, and the guy who's running the DUI course, Kavanaugh, it's Kavanaugh and Associates, a little plug for them, great DUI school. He was the former chief of Seal Beach PD, and he hadn't said, I'd been in the class for 3 days. He hadn't said a word to me other than just, you know, hey, how are you? And then Gordon Graham shows up on the third day or something, and he goes, hey, Gordon. And he's standing next to me when he says it. And Gordon goes, yeah. And he goes, hey, look at this guy. And he points at me, and I said, uh-oh, what'd I do? And Gordon goes, yeah. And he goes, this is Rob Gandy's kid. And both Gordon Graham and Bill Kavanaugh knew my dad and had not said a damn word for the first 3 days of the class. So I'm glad I didn't say anything stupid. So anyway, but we've got you on, and it's interesting. Charlie, you were saying to me that Brian actually kind of does kind of what we do, but in written form. Is that correct, Brian?
Yeah. So, I was involved in two fatal shootings with the Highway Patrol, and I'll be brief about it. But, you know, I spoke to friends and went to a counselor that we were required, and I spoke to a priest, and yet there were still certain things that kind of bugged me. So one day I was coming out of a uniform shop, and another officer ran into me, and he says, hey, aren't you Brian Smith? I said, yeah. And he goes, didn't you kill two people? And I was like, yeah. And then he goes, you know, I shot and killed a guy. And I'm not exaggerating. We probably stood there and spoke for about 3 hours.
Right.
And everything he was saying that he had gone through that I thought I had made up in my head, it was amazing to hear that this guy had gone through the same things, you know, and the different nightmares and the, you know, different issues that you had. And so I got more out of that 3 hours than any counseling or friend discussion. And so I actually made a pitch to the Highway Patrol. Hey, we need to form, you know, this was back in 90s, and I thought I invented the idea of peer support. And I went to our commissioners and made a pitch. Hey, we need a peer support group. And I thought they would try and put something together, and they actually turned and said, great idea. Why don't you go with it? So I found out that Boston PD and FBI had a form of it. And so I started to do all the research, and I put this program together. And so now I created the peer support program for the California Highway Patrol.
Wow.
And then through all these years, it's really been a great program. And of course, other people have taken it over and doing a great job with it. But then in the last few years, you know, because I'm older than you guys, but I grew up with Adam 12 and Chips.
Oh, I did too, but it was just reruns.
But Adam 12, Chips, The Rookies, and I watched all these TV shows. And if you go back and look, every single one of these TV shows, the cops are the good guys, and the community look up to them, and they help them. I'll tell you, and this is a challenge for all your viewers. You watch every movie, you watch every TV show, every cop is corrupt. And if you do happen to have a good cop, they're usually arresting a bad cop. And this is what our youth, this is what our community see, and this is what they're raised with, is that all cops are bad, and they're bad people, and they're corrupt. When it's, you know, when you look at the millions of police officers in this country, you know, we do a great job out there. And right. And you'll hear a bad story maybe every once in a while, and that's blown out. And so I just got tired of it. We were talking earlier about our joking with firemen.
Right.
I was watching Family Feud one day, and they said something about talked to 100 women and said, what would you like your husband? What occupation would you want him to have? Police officer wasn't even on there. And when they said fireman, I said, that's it. I'm doing something about this.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I started writing my stories. You know, I work Central LA, Bakersfield, some really busy offices. You know, I retired as assistant chief with the Highway Patrol, but I got into so much stuff while I was on the job that I started just writing my stories. And then I went to the newspaper, and they said, we'd love it to put. And the whole reason I did these articles was let people see the other side of it. Let them see how we actually help, that we're going into the firefight, how we're saving lives, how we're giving CPR to children, how we're seeing decapitated children. And we just go on with this stuff. And then I started to get other officers around the country to start sending me, emailing me their stories. And I'll tell you, there's some great stories. And now I'm in two newspapers. I'm trying to expand that, but I'm in two newspapers and a bunch of cop and other media, you know, the social media sites. I can't tell you how many letters, emails, text messages I get from people that say, hey, I wait every week for the newspaper just to read your articles. Right. And it's because they're reading these stories about what officers do every single day. And it's called Coptails. Anybody can go online, and if they just look up Californian Coptails, it'll show. I've done 114 articles, and each one has three stories in it. So over 300 stories already that are out there and printed, and I keep getting these stories.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, when we started this, you know, when I first met John and we started talking about police work, John had just recently been in a shooting within a year of me meeting him. And, you know, I had been in one and I was already retired, and we started talking about it. And I realized that, and we'd talked about after I retired stuff that was missing. We talked about that before we started. That was part of what was missing, is the camaraderie, the sharing, the discussion. And even in our recent episode with, Linz, the nurse who was addicted to medication, you know, one of the things I brought up and one of the things I bring up a lot is there's a magical moment that makes you, it's indescribable feeling in some ways, but the only word I can think of is this huge relief when you have all this garbage going on in your head. And then you meet somebody who's had a similar experience and you take a chance and you tell them about some of the garbage in your head and they go, oh my gosh, I thought I was the only one that felt that way. Or I thought I was the only one that thought that way. And as soon as you hear that somebody else thinks that way or feels that way, it's this big, it's an indescribable relief of, okay, I'm not crazy. I'm not an alien. I'm not going through this in a vacuum.
Exactly. And they just validated you, right?
Right, right.
And all that time because, hey, people that hadn't been there, like, you know, I had the first fatal shooting. I went back to work right away. 4 years later, an Uzi shooting. And then that one I had some issues with. And I even had a lieutenant that said, look, you knew you may have to do it. So you killed the guy, you know, let the shit go and get back to work. You know?
Right. And that was that was the big attitude.
And that was
attitude. Still is that attitude.
Yeah, right.
Still some people out there with that attitude. Hey, I even, you know, it's not just shootings, you know, it's other traumatic stuff, you know, as a commander, even as a sergeant lieutenant, but when people are involved in these really nasty situations, some of them are pretty bad. You know, I would always pull them aside. And I, even as a commander, I'd ask the sergeant, hey, is that officer okay? And they'd say, oh yeah, he's fine. I would take them aside. And many times those officers would break down and just really, you know, you could see how they felt. And so, you know, we have to put up that we're tough, we can handle it and all that. But I'll tell you, a lot of times, yeah, it doesn't mean everybody's going to be affected the same way. You may be in shooting or incidents and do just fine, right? That doesn't mean anything's wrong with you either. But it sure is, like you said, it sure is nice to, you know, even just to have those debriefings, you know, as long as you're not, you know, drinking too much, right? But just to have a debrief and talk to the guys, boy, it's probably the best you'll get. And for people watching your podcast here, there are a lot of people that are like, wow, I know that feeling. Hey, you know, I know you guys are available to talk. I'm always available to talk and give my information out sometime during this deal or my email for people to send me their stories. But also if they just want to talk and have that same feeling, because boy, it's day and night when you talk to somebody that understands what you're going through.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting too, because you'll find that veterans, firefighters, nurses, cops, anybody that deals with the tragedy of the human condition on a regular basis, as a professional, it's your job. You have to do it. You have to compartmentalize. It's not like you're dealing with it because you want to. You're just showing up and getting paid to deal with this crap. It's all very similar. We all have the same experiences. Even if the incidents that cause these traumas are different, the net effect on our psyche is the same.
And you know what I think is crazy is that when you're going through the academy or whatever, you have your instructors saying, oh, well, so blocking the academy where they're They're like, well, you need to make sure you keep your work at work and your home life at home. Don't combine the two. And the longer you get going on in this job, the more the two mesh and mold together. It's very easy to do it and keep it separate when you're, you know, a brand new boot on the street and you've got under 5 years on the job and haven't been involved in much. And the longer you get on, the more incidents and critical incidents and stuff like that you get involved in, more hairy stuff and crazy shit you start seeing and start doing, the more you're like, well, I don't think those academy instructors had any idea what the hell they were talking about, because you can't keep work at work and home at home. At some point they mesh. Right. And if you try to do it and keep it separate, it's like bottling up all your anger. At some point you're going to have a tipping point, and it's going to spew out, and it could be at the wrong time or place, like someone's wedding or, you know, some other public scenario where you don't want to drink, or
you just become an alcoholic or other things that come out. And you know what, I've always said it, you know, an old analogy is, you know, like trying to hold a beach ball underwater. You know, you can hold it underwater for as long as you can, but eventually you're not going to be able to hold it. It's going to pop up. And like Charlie was saying, you know, who knows when or where or how it's going to pop up. But I always, you know, I've always told couples where, because sometimes, you know, the wife or spouse, whatever it is, man, woman, but the one at home may not want to hear the stories. But I think that's kind of a disservice to the person who's working, because like I always came home and would discuss it with my wife, and that way it allowed me to get it out there, you know, and get it off my chest a little bit. And then even with officers, you know, I'm from right outside of Philadelphia. And I remember after the first shooting, my brother-in-law being a police officer back there. And when they got off work, they went out and had, you know, like chili dogs and a beer, you know, maybe two beers, but enough that it wasn't a problem to drive, but it was like choir practice. But they talked about the stuff and they joked and laughed. And I thought, wow. And so I brought that back to California in Ventura when I was in Ventura. And that's what we'd get together just for a couple of chili dogs. Some guys would drink soda or just have water or whatever they were going to have. But it was the idea of just getting together.
And I could have guessed you were from Philly because you drink water. so it's called Coptails, and people can find it online and in other publications. So now we're going to turn the tables on you, Brian, and we're going to have you pick a story, whether it's one of your shootings or an accident or whatever you want to share. The floor is yours. We're going to put you on the spot and have you share one of your Coptails. So go ahead. The mic is yours. And what's your story?
You know what? I've had, like I said, 300 and some stories, probably, believe it or not, probably about 100 of those are mine. I mean, I've really been in a lot of people always said I was a black cloud. And I always said, hey, the same stuff is happening around you. You're just missing it. Right.
Yeah. But, right. But we called it a shit magnet, but
yeah, it's there, right? I'm not making it happen. It's there.
Right.
I have so many stories that I think are very entertaining, but the one story that I think has just really, there's two really, one from Lancaster and then, you know, one from Bakersfield. So I'll tell you, when I was a commander, I was the captain of the Bakersfield Highway Patrol, and I get a call about 12:30 that we have a triple fatal. And so I roll out there. Well, what happened was, is a mother and her four young daughters, aged 9 through probably 16, they were coming from Flagstaff, Arizona, headed to Northern California because their dad was on a job and they were going to, you know, surprise them and visit them. Well, there was a big rig, a flatbed truck that ran out of gas, and he almost made it to the shoulder, but the flatbed was sticking out into the number 3 lane in the slow lane. She came from the 1 freeway onto the northbound 99 and just sheared the hole because it was at night. No. Didn't see the truck sticking out and sheared the whole right side of the Suburban. Well, the mother was sitting in the driver's seat. The 9-year-old was sitting behind her. And then she had a daughter, 3 of them sitting right behind each other, front seat, middle seat, back seat. And it killed all 3 of the daughters. Ugh. The only survivor, her only surviving daughter was the 9-year-old. So I stopped by to pick up. I called the local priest that I know, very popular in Bakersfield, and I asked if he would go with me, and I picked him up, and we went. I went to the scene first, then I picked up the priest, and then we went to the hospital. And he stayed with the mother and, you know, consoled her. And I went in with the 9-year-old, and I was talking to her and calming her down. And the next, and then a local lady here in Bakersfield called and said she wanted to take care of hotel rooms, whatever. So we put him in a hotel room for the night. The next day I went to Toys R Us, and I just bought our bunch of toys and stuffed animals, went back, spent the time and stayed with them until finally family was able to come and pick them up and take them back to Flagstaff, Arizona. And 9 years later, I actually went to her high school graduation.
Wow.
And when I retired, the husband, wife, and the 9-year-old, well, now, you know, late,
yeah,
older.
Now 18, yeah.
Yeah, they came to my retirement party here in Bakersfield, and we stay in touch all the time, and yet the mother and I, and so her daughter is about the same age as my son, who's going to San Jose State on his master's degree right now, a great hockey player, throw that in. But okay. Anyway.
All right, hockey.
But they're really close, and I talk to the mother all the time, and I'll tell you, all these years later, just a struggle every day for her to survive, and I know she's only surviving for her daughter. That's the only thing that's keeping her going is her daughter.
She'd lost all four of those daughters.
She lost three of the four.
And if she had lost all four to her own driving, I don't know. I mean,
probably wouldn't be here.
Which wasn't even, you know, she wasn't even at fault. I mean, see it, but yeah, it's her daughter that kept her alive. That's the only thing that has kept her alive in all these years.
But it's interesting that you stayed in touch. You see stories like this, and it makes the news occasionally, but I don't think it gets enough. It never gets enough press because it doesn't outdo all the bullshit stories about, you know, some cop that does something, you know, scandalous, because we all know it happens. I mean, the people that hate bad cops the most are good cops.
Right. Or it's not even
100%.
The stuff that makes it on the media is not even like, oh, well, these are bad cops. It just doesn't look good.
Right.
It doesn't look good, but it's completely 100% justified. And yet the public doesn't understand that police work is a dirty job. It's not a clean job. It's not clean cut. And these stories, especially like what Brian, what he did and what many other cops around the country are doing, don't see the attention that they deserve and they need. And we're not don't do this job for attention or, you know, for a pat on the back. But when you're doing these nice things for people, and it is nice every once in a while if people would recognize, instead of harp on all the stuff that doesn't look great on camera or the bad apples out there that are doing dumb shit, you know?
And for me, I always tell people, and I've said this on the show for longtime listeners, law enforcement is like sausage. Don't watch how it's made. Just enjoy it. Because, yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, because, you know, everybody who doesn't love a good breakfast sausage or a good, you know, kielbasa or a good Polish sausage on the grill. But let me tell you, it's not pretty how it's made. Well, law enforcement is the same way. Enjoy your safety. And the military is also the same way. Enjoy the safety that the military and law enforcement provide to you. But understand that providing that safety isn't always pretty. And sometimes we have to do the things that other people don't want to do. But it's a necessity, and it's an ugly necessity because life is ugly. So, you know, it's
kind of... Can you even find an occupation where you think of the hundreds of thousands of police officers in the United States, each officer, how many incidents in a year that they handle?
Right.
You're talking to millions of incidents. And then every once in a while, one pops up where somebody gets a cop on video that, hey, this is a bad thing. You know, most people do support the police, and this is something we forget. But the attention goes to, you know, look, you have the media, academia, and Hollywood that they're constantly running us down. Fine, show me another class or another job where people can be this successful and do the things that we do day in and day out. It's not a matter of, hey, look, you're going to have your bad cops. Well, of course, you're going to have them anywhere. But we go through a pretty, you know, rigorous background. We cut people. We don't take them. And when we do find bad cops, You talk about the thin blue line. We don't want them there.
No, exactly.
I've always said, as a commander, a sergeant, or anything in position, look, if you're out there and you have a good heart and you're trying to do a good job and you screw up somehow, hey, I'm going to take you on. You may get paper, but I'm going to defend you because I know that you had good intentions and you made a mistake. But on the other hand, you're a cop and you do drugs, you take a bribe, you do bad things, you have a black heart, you make us look bad. You don't want me to be there, because I'll tell you what, I will take you down and you don't have a chance with me, because I don't want those people in this. The problem is it's just a breakdown of society, not to get political, but this is all just another breakdown of society. People looked up to police. Police were there to protect us. It's authority. They want to break it down. And I'll tell you what's going to happen with all these new things. Like, they're trying to say now you have to be 20. They're trying to pass. You have to be 26 or have a bachelor's degree to be a police officer. They're trying to get away with qualified immunity so that they can now sue you, or you can go to prison for making a mistake on the job.
Right.
So who's going to become the cops now? Not your smart people, not your intelligent people, not people that can reason and have common sense. It's going to be the people that are wannabes that could never become a police officer. And that's what they're going to get.
And bachelor's degrees, I mean, let's face it, you can have a degree and still be a fucking idiot.
Yep.
So, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, so you had another story. I don't want to get too far derailed before we get a chance to have you share. You said there were two stories, so I want to make sure we get back to.
Well, the one was even brutal, but I instead I decided to go with another one just because I think this hits everybody. Mm-hmm. So when I was a deputy chief, we were playing hockey, and we came back in a locker room, and here somebody stole a bunch of our wallets and cell phones and stuff. And so I jumped on it, and the city said that they wanted to turn the phone off. And I said, no, no. And I don't want to get into the techniques, how we got them, because I don't want to.
No, we don't want to give away investigative.
Yeah, we don't want to give away any of that. But make a long story short, I found where they were at. I called one of my officers. Hey, you in the area? And then when I called it in and said, I have them, well, I came around. I just wanted to drive by the house to see what it looked like. Well, just as I did, this van is sitting there and all these, you know, criminal type people getting out. Turns out, long story short,
this is the place for it.
Okay. Well, it was a stolen. The van was stolen. They had expensive, like these $2,500 bicycles in the back that they stole. And then our cell phones were in there and some drugs. So it was a great hit. And because I had put it out here, two officers, so we sat everybody down on the curb. Two officers from the sheriff showed up. Two of the Shafter showed up and two Bakersfield PD show up. And so I had said to the guy, so you stole my cell phone and stuff. Well, when they saw those units, one of the guys that stole it said, all because he sees six cars there, he says, all this just for one stolen cell phone. And one of the officers jokingly said, hey, you don't screw with our chief. You know? So this is where the story comes in. As I was about to go over and do something else, one of the officers said to me, hey, chief, this guy here, the guy that stole your phone, he wants to talk to you right now. And I walked up and I said, yeah, what's up? And he goes, hey, you remember me? And I said, no. He said, we used to play hockey together years ago. And I was, you know, I played with you a few times. I go, no, I don't remember. He goes, I just wanted to tell you that I was married. I had a kid. Life was good. And I got hooked on drugs. And all of a sudden, my wife, you know, she separated. And then she took my visitation rights away. I haven't seen my kid in a while. And I was coaching him in hockey. And my whole world fell apart. He goes, and I just stopped by the rink that day just to reminisce. And I noticed that you guys never really looked at the locker rooms. He goes, and I, being a drug addict, I went in there and I stole all this stuff from you guys. I stole your wallets. He goes, but I just want to tell you that I'm truly sorry. I really mean that. And I said, yeah, well, I don't want to hear it.
Right.
And he goes, hey, can't you forgive me? I said, no. I go, you're not sorry you did it. You're sorry you got caught. And I said, and he goes, but I would like it if you forgave me. I go, and I turn around and I said, you want me to forgive you? You straighten your act up. I said, I'll tell you what, you get off drugs and you straighten your act up, then you come talk to me and I'll talk to you about forgiving you. So I left about 2 years later, I was at one of the Bakersfield Condors hockey games, and I'm walking through the hall, and some guy comes up, and this guy originally had tattoos on his neck and on his face, and so this guy walks up, and he's got a ball cap, and I can see faded tattoos, but I thought it was a guy from Teen Challenge because I used to help out and go to their fundraisers and stuff. And this guy walks up, and he has a little boy with him, and he says, Steve Smith. And I go, yeah. And he goes, you remember me? I go, yeah. Are you one of the guys from Teen Challenge? He says, no, I'm the guy that stole your wallet and your cell phone. And I go, really? He said, yeah, I've been coming to these games to try and find you. He said, I listened to what you said, and I went clean, and I'm sober, and I'm in the process of getting my tattoos removed. My wife and I are working things out, and you can see I'm with my son now. He goes, do you forgive me now? And I'll tell you what, we just reached for each other and gave each other a big hug. And I said, you're damn right, Ann. He says, you know, when you told me you wouldn't forgive me until I cleaned up, I made it my mission to clean it up. And he goes, and I've been sober and clean ever since then. And I tell you that story because that's probably one of the, you know, big success stories that you just don't hear about, you know?
No, and we don't tell those stories.
Yeah.
We don't tell the stories. I'm glad you shared that one, because to me, those are the personal ones. Like I'll talk to people if they really want to hear the gory, nasty, you know, the guy had a glass meth pipe in his ass or had to dig it out with a pen. You want to hear that those stories? I'll tell you those stories all day long. But
and that's just from your family reunions.
Yeah, that was last week. I had my brother over for dinner. no, but the ones, like, I have a couple of stories where, you know, my wife knows about it or some close friends and stuff know about it, but it's because like what you're saying, they're personal. It's following up with somebody or somebody following up with me and telling me that what I did made a difference in their life. Those are more personal to me, and those are harder to tell because, you know, it's emotional because you want, that's why you get into this job. You want to be reading, like you said, reading Malloy, you know? And we always talk about on this show, you oftentimes don't get follow-up. You put your finger in somebody's bullet hole or hold somebody's face together after an accident, or, you know, hold a woman's hand while you tell her husband is dying or something like that. And then they end up at the hospital or wherever they're going to end up, and you never see them again, ever.
Right.
And that happens so often that when you do finally talk to somebody and get follow-up, that's a very personal thing to me.
Yeah. You just said something, and it reminded me of another cocktail that I put the notes down, that another story that I ever forgot about. No, I don't mean to tell you that I need to put my next cocktail that I did that I totally forgot. Yeah, did we have time for that one more?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, and this one, not to say names, but I did get permission from the person that it was okay to talk about this. But probably when I said the daughters, I have a tie for two of the worst days of my career. And this is the other one. And that was where we get a call. Here, this husband drove to work and he forgot his lunch. So he calls us, we find this story out, the whole rest of the story later. But he calls his wife who doesn't really, she can't speak English. She doesn't have a driver's license, but he needed his lunch. So she throws her kids. She has her niece visiting from LA, and this is out in Lancaster. So she throws Palmdale, Lancaster. She throws the kids in the van, and she has her 12-year-old niece and four other kids, one being an infant, and she drives this van, and then she drops off the lunch, and on her way home, she's coming around the curve, and she goes to hit the brake. She's going a little too fast, but she hits the accelerator instead of the brake and just plunges right into the aqueduct.
Oh.
And this van is underwater. And the divers get there, and they go down, and we're sitting there, and the officer that I'm with, the main officer, him and I are standing on the bank. The CHP helicopter is landed on the bank in case any of them survive. We can hurry up and life flight them to the hospital. And the divers brought the mother up and laid her down and put the body blanket over. Then he brought the next child up, and then the next one. So it's the mother and five children and the infant. They bring the little infant up, and the infant's dead, and they cover the infant. And so we had to stand there and watch this as they brought out each body, and we're watching the, you know, the drenched bodies. And so then I left the officer there while I went, ran to the store, and I grabbed some drinks and sodas. And well, before I did that, I had a, we got the license plate off the van, and I drove to the house because I had to make notification to let them know what happened.
Those are the words.
He wasn't home. He was at work. I didn't know this at the time. But on the way back from his house, driving back to the scene, I stopped at the store and I said, hey, can I get, you know, I went and bought drinks and, you know, donuts to take back. Of course, donuts. But to take back to the scene for everybody. While I'm there, the dispatcher calls me and she tells me, the officer at the scene, that dispatch just got a call that officer's wife had just committed suicide.
Ugh.
And I, after him watching these bodies being brought out, I said to her, I go, wow, did somebody tell him? How's he taking it? And they said, well, he doesn't know yet. We need you to tell him.
Oh.
So I got back to the scene and I said to him, hey, let's go for a walk. And as we went walking, he had two small children. I had to tell him, and I knew his wife, you know, everybody was close in the office.
Sure.
And, so I told him and I said, look, let's get in a helicopter and let's go there. And we flew to where she was at and he wanted to go in. And I told him, look, you probably, you know, they told me how it didn't look good. And so I told him, look, I'll go in so that if you ever have questions. And when I got there, she had a note and little gifts for her kids. And I won't describe the horrible scene that I saw. But it was a horrible scene. And then I had to, you know, stay with him. And when we finally got him with family and calmed down and thinking everything was over, well, now I had to go back to the original husband's house and tell him about, you know, his wife and kids.
Oh, Jesus.
So, that day was, you know, just telling you, I can, my stomach's churning, you know,
just going
through the whole thing again. And that was, you know, and the other one, probably the worst. And like I said, if you read all these other stories, you'll see that there were just a lot of stories, just one after another, you know, that we see. So,
yeah, notifications are one of the worst things ever, especially because I don't know about you. I'm sure Brian, you guys had the same thing. I don't know how LAPD handles it, but when somebody dies in Georgia and their daughter lives in, you know, you were working in Bakersfield, they're going to call Bakersfield and, you know, the law enforcement agency is going to say, hey, do you have a girl named so-and-so that lives in Bakersfield? Yeah, we do. Okay. Her mom just died. Can you drive over there and tell her? So it's not even like, sometimes it's just a random, like, here, somebody has to go deliver really terrible news to this woman. So we're going to get the police to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sucks all the time.
And you instantly become a grief counselor.
You know, and the worst part is that drive. Now, a lot of times the coroner's office will, you know, do a lot of them for you. I always did all the, you know, the ones where it looked like it was going to take too long for the coroner's office to get there and stuff. I did it because I just always figured, hey, as a parent, I want to know right away. So there are a lot of them that I did that I could have put off to the coroner's office, but I didn't want them to wait. And I've actually stayed friends with some of those families that I told them. But like you say, that drive there is the longest drive ever. And you are now going to be the messenger for somebody on the worst day of their life.
Yep.
You are the person that's breaking the news on the worst day of their life.
Yeah. Well, quick story is, we got a call of, I was working with one of my favorite mentors, working a two man car together. Cause we normally rolled one man cars like chippies do during the day and stuff like that. And, we were just happened to be rolling a two-man car and we got shots fired, possible female gunshot victim. And we were really close by. We were less than a mile away and it was, you know, shots fired. So we're not sure what we have. And so we got there really fast. And when we got there, a guy comes out. It was one of those kinds of houses. It was a, you know, common wall house. And then they had, the hedges right at the street, at the sidewalk. So, you know, it's, we hate it. You approach the house, you can't see through the hedges. You don't know what's on the other side of it. So as we park, you know, two houses away, three houses away, and we get out and we start to walk up. And we've got guns drawn and stuff. And then a guy just comes running out from between the hedges and he's got a little bit of blood on his hands and he's going, "She's still warm. She's still warm." So my partner, you know, guns him and puts him down on the ground because we don't know what his involvement is. And I go back to where he just came from. And there's a, what must have been a lovely 19-year-old blonde girl who is no longer lovely because she took a 22 caliber rifle and put it to her temple and blew herself away on the front porch of this house. And we go through, you know, the investigation to find out whose house this is. Da, 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 da. We clear the house. Turns out she was dating a married man who had left his wife. And they'd spent all summer dating. And at the end of the summer, the guy tells her, "Hey, I need to make it work with my family. I'm breaking up with you." And she took it so hard that she got a gun. Well, first thing she did was she tried to slash her wrist, you know, a couple of days prior, because we could see this heat, you know, the bandage. And when she got stopped from doing that, she really decided to send a message to this guy. And she went and got a rifle from her father's gun safe and killed herself on his front porch just to really spit in his eye and send him a message. I'll show you
his front porch.
Yes. So yeah. She went to his house and shot herself on his front porch to send him a message about breaking up with her. And I'll never forget. She was, you know, I went to check her pulse. She was still warm. We ran the gun and the gun belonged to her father and she lived with her parents. And I had to go tell, you know, I had to go talk to the mom and dad and the sister happened to be home as well and tell them, "Your daughter's dead. Can you go check and see if one of your guns is missing from your safe? Because we're pretty sure she took one of your guns and used one of your guns to kill herself." Yeah. And that was pretty rough. And then I watched the sister break down because the sister had known about the suicide attempt a couple of days before and kept it a secret because her sister asked her not, "Don't tell mom and dad."
Wow. She should have been put on a hold.
Well, she was put on a hold temporarily. And then she said all the right things and got out. And then her sister knew about it, but her sister was trying to, you know, cover for her. So she didn't tell mom and dad. So now you've got dad feeling guilty because it was his gun. And then you've got the daughter feeling guilty because she didn't say anything. And I'm just standing there looking at these people like, I'm sorry. I, you know, what else do you say?
Yeah.
Do you need a chaplain? Do you have a family pastor? You know, it's just.
And suicides are real tough too. And especially when, you know, you know, and different people with experience that through depression that, you know what, there's always a sunny day after. You don't see it at the moment. You don't think that things are ever going to get better. And yet, suicides are bad and you just feel so helpless. And the people that know them, you know, that takes the whole family out when you do a suicide because everybody starts questioning what they could have done and how they could have helped. So, yeah,
I tell people all the time, I said, someone who kills himself is taking their pain and just transferring it onto everybody in their family.
Yeah.
That's all they're doing.
Transferred intent.
Yeah.
Their exactly. pain to their pain.
Unfortunately, when you're at that point, you're not in your right state of mind. You know, like I hear people say that's the most selfish thing you can do. And yeah, I mean, that's true if you look at it from a reasonable point. But sometimes people get that way.
They're not
thinking logically, you know, right. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, you guys both had very bleak stories of telling people their loved one had died and stuff like that. And I have a quick one that maybe will put a smile on people's faces that maybe listening.
Yeah. They're ready to sit in a tub of warm water and
right. They're like, episode. Oh, these are rough. we got a call, being a station call and, a lady, I guess, had called in and this old woman, this mom, she had passed away, different state. And family members out there needed to tell the next of kin, her daughter, her only living daughter, that her mother had died. And I was like, oh, geez, great. And the last thing I want to do. And we were the only clear unit. And so the Volun told us to go and do this. And we go and we get the information. We find out who the person is. And we go to do a door knock. And the whole time I'm driving there, I'm talking to my partner, you know, trying to joke and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, I really hope this person isn't there. I really don't want to do this. I would much rather not have to do this right now, first thing in the morning before I even had my breakfast.
Right.
Is to go and tell this news. And this is during this whole COVID thing. You know, a few months back, actually it was almost a year ago when the COVID thing first started and the whole mask thing. And people were like, oh, I can't go outside without a mask. I can't even open my door because the COVID bugs are going to attack my face.
They thought the whole world had been infected.
Right. So I go and knock on this door. And so I knock pretty loud. I mean, us as police officers, we have that trademark knock.
Yeah.
And so I knock.
Boom, boom, boom.
Nothing. And I'm like, all right, cool. I'm going to do it one more time on body camera and we're going to leave. Bam, bam, bam. I hear, what do you want? I'm like, it's the police. Well, it's COVID. I'm not coming out. I said, I don't want to yell this. I'm start feeling uncomfortable at this point. I'm like, I really need to talk to you. And are you so-and-so? And they're like, yeah, I'm so-and-so. And I said, okay, well, can you open the door? Can I talk to you? No, I'm not opening the door. COVID. And I said, ma'am, I don't want to yell this out loud. I don't want your neighbors to hear. People are kind of looking out the window at us. And I don't want to air your news, your whole neighborhood. And finally she opens the door and she goes, what do you want? And I'm like, I just want to let you know. And she goes to close the door. I was like, look, I need to tell you something. She goes, what? And I go, fuck it, fine. Your mom's dead. And she goes, oh, I don't care about her. Slams the door. I was like, oh, thank God. Wow. And you apparently they didn't have a good relationship.
You're the only one who felt bad about the death like, notification in that scenario.
Man, this is horrible. I was, my stomach was turning, and she opens back door and she's like, look, I don't care about my mom. We don't have a good relationship. And I was like, well, that's kind of sad, but
okay,
I get it. Yeah. And she's like, nah, whatever. She's a mean person anyways. I was like, okay, well, you need anything? She's like, no. I was like, all right, see you later. And we leave and we go away and we're laughing. We're like, oh, well, at least that went okay. You know,
you should have said they found $1 million in her house and they didn't know what to do with it. You see how much she would have loved her then, right?
Yeah, I wish. I mean, I probably would have gotten in trouble when she found out there's $1 million and it was all over body cameras. I would have gotten in trouble.
So Brian, you worked at Shafter, and I have a weird, I was mentioning this. I have a weird connection to Shafter only because, at my department, we had a guy who had previously worked at Taft PD.
Yeah.
And Taft is a small town, small jerkwater town, as we described it, real close to Shafter. So we had a sergeant who got so sick of hearing, you know, well, back in Taft stories, that he made it a thing at our department that anytime anyone had to, you know, anytime anyone told a back in my day story, they would start it with, well, back in Shafter, when I was at.
So, you know what's funny too is you know what? I've been doing backgrounds with Taft PD.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, man, I had dealings with them in the past with the Highway Patrol and never had any bad stories, but I'll tell you what, once I got to know that, well, what you talk about a great department. I'm not just saying that because I'm there now.
All right.
But I'm telling you, just everybody in that place is just so outgoing and friendly, you know, at the police station and stuff there that, and at City Hall that, wow, I really, all those years working at Bakersfield, I had no idea, but it really, you'd be surprised. I mean, that, well, not surprised, but it is a really good, everybody knowing everybody. That's kind of a nice thing about working out there too, you know?
Isn't it interesting that what we end up, you know, departments develop their own kind of personality and identity in a lot of ways, which is very weird because you're saying everybody at Taft is, you know, this nice, this, that, the other thing. And then you've got departments where, you know, you talk to cops and they'd be like, oh, that department, they shoot people. They you know, like,
and you know, what's funny is it's like everything else we talked about, like even Shafter, you know, they have some great people that work out there. All you need are one or two people at any department, whether you're, you know, you're talking about any of our departments or not, man, it's funny that unfortunately a lot of times people will remember just the negative about things sometimes, you know, and one or two people can ruin the image of an agent. But even look at even some supervisors, you can have people that love to go to work every day a new supervisor or manager comes in, and all of a sudden the morale goes down, people hate their job. I always said everywhere I worked, the two most important things to me, and they're tied for importance, is officer safety and employee morale.
Yep.
To me, they're the two most important things you can have in any office.
And, yep. And far too much, I see that disappearing because people are metaphorical climbers. It's more important for them to get theirs and for them to promote as high as they can and, you know, get that status that they forget about the people that are going to make it work for them and make it happen, which would be the backbone of any department, which would be patrol, because they're the tip of the spear and they're out there doing, you know, the hard work every single day. And you have the you know, sometimes these command staff that come in, whether it be at certain agencies, it might be a sergeant or it might be a lieutenant or it might be a captain or a new chief or something like that, depending on the size of your department.
Sure.
And a lot of them have this new mentality, burn them to learn them. And that's not a good mentality to have, and it tanks morale. And next thing you know, when you have morale that's completely gone, you have officers that are showing up for a paycheck and they're going to handle the calls and they're going out in their car. And you might have some good supervisors, direct supervisors that, you know, that they like, and they're all kind of in the suck together. And they're out there, you know, doing the job. But when it comes back to the station, you know, their life is just in the shitter at the station. Their work life is being crapped all over because you have someone who doesn't really care. So it's nice to hear that, you know, Brian was very high up in the CHP, very high up in Shafter. And he had that mentality where it's morale is first, your officers are first, you know, let's make it comfortable for them. They have to toe the line, but at the same time, let's make sure we have good morale, because if you don't have morale, you don't have a workforce.
Yeah.
And, or at least a very good one.
And commanders like that, Brian, let me tell you, I wish I could have worked for you, because those are few and far between. I had a lieutenant who I loved because his philosophy was, you know, I could literally get rid of every division at this department except patrol. Without patrol, you might as well not have a police department. I can get rid of canines. I can get rid of school resource. I can even get rid of detectives, because really patrol could do their own investigations. But ultimately, you need patrol. And for the basic, you know, it's like the infantry in the military, you know, you have to have it. And without it, you might as well not have a military. Well, the same thing with patrol. Without it, you might as well not have a police department. And yet somehow, the higher up you go, it seems that the meat and potatoes of patrol becomes less and less important and less a priority. And it's kind of looked at as, you know, the lowest possible level.
Yeah. Or you going for a promotional exam or some sort of specialization, and they're like, oh, you've only been patrol. Yeah,
yeah, for 12 fucking years.
Yeah, I've been doing this my whole career, which means I'm an expert out in the field and dealing and talking with people and the investigative side. Duh, dummy.
You're right.
But they're like, oh, that's like a bad thing. Well, you're like, well, I'm sorry I haven't, you know greased the wheels a little bit.
Retire out of patrol, and how they're looked at as like, oh, you just never left patrol. Look at you. You never went to Yeah, because I wanted to push a black and white for 25, 30 years and actually do police work.
You know, when I was a young officer, my mentor, he was a sergeant, Rob Paris. I believe he's still reserve sheriffs, you know, became an attorney. But this guy told me early on, he says, the higher you go, the more people you can help. Instead of saying the higher you go, the better off you'll be.
Right.
His philosophy, and I've always lived by this, the higher you go, the more people you can help. And you know what? Even though, like, when I was assistant chief, I had Kalinga, I had Oakhurst, and this is, I'm not telling you this about me. I'm just telling you about people watching it when they promote. I had to drive 2 hours to Fresno, which burnt me out. Otherwise, if I didn't have that 2-hour drive every day, I'd still be on the patrol working for free right now. That's how much I love my job. But even after working, I would still go to Kalingo on graveyards just to visit the graveyard staff. I'd go to Oakhurst. I went to dispatch centers, even on graveyards when I was a commander, and with clerical and the janitors. And you know what? The whole thing, and when people say, hey, it was great when you were a commander, it wasn't great that I was a commander. You know, it wasn't hard. It was the fact that it was family to me. To this day, I'm still involved with most people with the Highway Patrol because to me, it wasn't a job. It was family. And those people were my family. And when you promote to assistant chief, they're not your, you know, you're just a chief that goes to the different offices. And that was the hardest part for me to promote was that, hey, I guess I'm not the daddy now, right? I mean, I still wanted to be out there with the troops. I still went out and visited them. But for me personally, it was a little harder because I wanted to be, you know, still with them and stuff. And I'll tell you the biggest advice that I can tell anybody that's thinking about promoting or has promoted and you're going to continue to promote is exactly what Rob told me. And to this day, if you go to any class and anybody ever worked for Rob Paris and they say, who is the best commander or who is the best, you know, leader that you know of? I've been in other classes before when I used to work there, and it would always be Rob Paris's name came up because he genuinely cared about people 24 hours a day. You know, and same thing, I told officers, if it's a chain of command, then you go through your sergeant and your lieutenant before you get to me. You don't get to come to me and ask me for a day off or anything like that unless you go through the chain. But if you have issues or personal things you want to talk about, you can call me at home. Don't be afraid, even as a chief, you call me at home if you have personal issues or something you want to talk about. As long as I'm not undermining the job of the supervisor, the lieutenant or the managers, because I don't want to undermine their position.
Yeah, don't jump the chain of command for work stuff. But if you're a friend, stuff. I'm here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
and I can truly attest to that, Tom.
Yeah, I know. Because
his work ethic is no shit, no joke. I mean, when he was the lieutenant and I want to say captain at the Antelope Valley office for CHP, I mean, he one, helped my father out a bunch of times with personal stuff. And two, he had no problem picking me up and taking me with his family to, you know, a theme park or anything like that. And really treated everybody there at that station when I was young, and I can see it now, as family. And it was, that's probably a trait that has probably gone by the wayside in many agencies now.
Oh yeah.
But it really shouldn't.
No, we should still be that family. So as we're closing, I wanted to get, since I got you here, Brian, and we all have some very different backgrounds and experiences. This was an email. I'll cut out some of the middle stuff because it was about something we discussed on Locker Room, and it's a little personal, but there is some stuff that I talked to Adam, and Adam said we could discuss it and answer his question on this podcast. So it says, hey guys, my name is Adam Selig, currently serving 12 years in the Chair Force in Fairbanks, Alaska. Let me tell you, sitting behind a computer for 9 hours a day, listening to your podcasts makes my day not suck so bad. So that's kind of nice. Nice. Doing the podcast makes my day not suck so bad. So that's, you know, helps. Let's see, it says, I've had two quote-unquote deployments with the Air Force to Kuwait in 2011 and Djibouti, my favorite name, by the way, Djibouti, in 2015 in my career. I'm about to PCS to Nellis Air Force Base next month. Ooh, write us when you get to Nellis. I want to fucking hear about the aliens. I want to know about all the secret alien shit.
You're going to disappear, Tom.
I know, right? I'm about to PCS to Nellis Air Force Base next month and can't wait for warmer temps. Anyway, I just wanted to reach out and say thank you. I've got 8 years left and I'm looking towards law enforcement when I get out. I feel like law enforcement would be way better than what I currently do. Tom, do you have any recommendations on which agency is better than other, i.e. sheriff, state patrol, county, etc.? Any feedback would be awesome. Keep doing what you're doing. Please feel free to share this email with listeners, Adam. So I thought, that's now that I have a city cop here and I've got a highway patrolman here, we can have a really good couple minutes of discussion about what Adam is wondering as to what kind of agency he should go to. And my initial reaction, Adam, is it depends on what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. And definitely not in California.
Oh, God. That's, yeah. If you're in
you
Alaska,
can't be a cop in California.
Stay there.
The best advice I think I would give him is, you know, you, like you said, you got to know what you want. generally sheriff's departments, you know, they're going to be patrolling counties and unincorporated cities. When you're in the unincorporated cities, I mean, you're generally going to be one man to a car, and this is based on California standards, which probably holds true most all over the country.
Yeah.
When you're in a municipal, an unincorporated city, you're going to be rolling one to a car, and you're in the unincorporated areas, which are the counties and stuff like that, or the county sections. Those are a lot more rural. You're probably rolling two into a car. But at the same time, you're going to be doing a lot more things such as serving subpoenas, and you're going to be doing evictions and things like that on the sheriff's side. And you're probably going to have to do some jail time detention officer, not a detention officer, but a jailer.
Well, so
but you're
still a cop. That's an LA thing. A lot of that's an LA thing. I'll tell you, our sheriff's department, they had two classifications. And I actually prefer this. You apply to be a correctional officer, and then you get a job, and you're hired by the sheriff's department as a correctional deputy. And that's your title, correctional deputy. And you can stay a correctional deputy and promote to sergeant, lieutenant, captain, whatever, stay in the jail. Or if you want to come out onto the street, then you apply for another job, and that job is patrol deputy. And then that's a whole different other job. So you can actually just, if you have the experience, you're coming out of the military, you're coming on from another department, you can apply for a patrol deputy position. But a lot of times what they do is they prioritize people who are already correctional deputies.
Right. Okay.
As employees they would hire for patrol deputies. So it's two different job classifications, but one can help lead you to the other, as opposed to what you're talking about, which is how LA Sheriff's does it, which is everybody who gets hired goes to the jail first.
Orange County and Ventura County, I believe, do the exact same way.
And San Francisco Sheriff, if you can believe this, San Francisco has a sheriff department. The only thing they do is the jail. That's it. Because their jurisdiction is
so small.
The city of San Francisco. So San Francisco PD handles everything outside of the jail. And my understanding is San Francisco County just handles the jail.
Well, if there is no county area, right? Then
right. If there's no incorporated area to patrol, makes sense.
You know, one of the things that I would tell him to look into as well is I believe that his military time would go towards his retirement, if I'm not mistaken, if he goes federal, right? So he may want to.
In some cases with state, you can apply.
Well, usually you have to buy it, though. Yeah. Usually you have to buy it. But I believe if he goes federal, he'd have to look into that. But, you know, he could have, you know, FBI, Secret Service, any of that stuff.
Three-letter boys.
Yeah, you can do one of those.
Definitely
jobs. I'll tell you, for me, I wanted to be a Pennsylvania state trooper since I was 5 years old. That's all I ever wanted to be. But basically, I wanted to be a cop.
Right.
And so when I came to California, I wanted to be Pennsylvania state trooper, but after being in California for 3 years, working in that cold weather, icy stuff, I mean, there are other reasons as well. So what I decided was I went for a ride along with the sheriff's department down in San Diego County, and I had a great time. I enjoyed it. It was great. And then I rode with Oceanside Police Department. I had a great time, came home, told my wife, wow, I loved it. And then I rode with the Highway Patrol, and I said, this is what I'm doing the rest of my life. It was the greatest thing. And then I'll just tell you a story. I probably shouldn't tell you because it's kind of maybe not a good story. But when I went to an orientation for the Highway Patrol, I'm telling you, there are probably 400 people in this gym. And the Highway Patrol recruiter was up on stage. And there's like 400 of us in there. And he goes, I want everybody in the room right now to look around this room. And we looked around. He says, statistics tell us out of this entire room, only two of you will successfully become a highway patrolman. And I remember looking around the room thinking, I wonder who the other one is.
Exactly.
True story.
Some of that, you have to have that attitude. I'll tell you, I had a similar one. It was the beginning of the background process. So everybody that had made it to the background for the sheriff's department I was applying to got pulled into the room and got the same speech at the same time and the same instructions. So they didn't have to give it over and over and over.
Right.
And they said, so, you know, don't lie, you know, if there's stuff in your background you're not proud of, let's get it out and talk about it. And, you know, a lot of stuff can be worked with, especially if it was a long time ago, blah, 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 giving you that whole speech. And one guy, when they said, do you have any questions? He raised his hand. They said, yeah, go ahead. So he stands up and in front of about 40 people, he looks at this undersheriff who's giving this speech and says, so if you're asking about things like prostitution or drug use, like have I ever been with a hooker or if I've ever smoked pot, if somebody was in Amsterdam where it was legal, do they have to put that on the form? and we all kind of giggled and we're like, bro, you need to put it on the form now because you just admitted to it.
Hey, I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I will, and for Adam and anybody else that's watching this that wants to be an officer, more people fail the background because of not being honest and not completely filling out their personal history statement from day one, more than failing the background because of what they didn't say.
Right.
So people will say, hey, should I put down that I did drug use? And people go, well, who knows you did drug use? Well, really, nobody that they'll ever know about. Then don't put it down, right? That's what the advice they give. Towards the end, now they're going into the polygraph. And so they're like, oh, I forgot to tell you this, or I forgot to tell you that. And guess what? We don't care whether you really did forget or not. You're out. If you're not honest from day one, that means every job you ever had. And when you fill out your personal history statement, you look up the address, the phone numbers. Don't put unknown. You be as accurate on those personal history statements, because our philosophy is this should be the most enthusiastic you are to get a job is in the beginning. And if you're lazy on this, how are you going to be as an officer? So you get eliminated. You get eliminated now. So be honest about every single thing and be as accurate and as neat as you can. And wear a suit to every single meeting you have, unless they tell you.
Shave your face
and shave. Yeah. Oh, and I'll tell you, the hiring process is invasive. It feels, in some cases, like your privacy is like you have not. I mean, it's a tough process to go through.
It's especially gut wrenching.
Yeah, it can. There's some really serious like even if you don't have a shitty background, there's some stuff where you're like, oh god, this is terrible. Like I hate feeling like I'm a criminal because I'm being investigated this thoroughly. Yeah. But I could tell you two pieces of advice on the heels of what Brian just said. Number one, in California, and for those of you in other states, I'm guessing they have a similar thing, or if they don't, just go onto California's website. There is a standard personal history statement background packet that the state of California has, and a lot of agencies use it. Some agencies have their own version of it, but it's relatively similar. You can download it and you can fill it out ahead of time. Right. So if you spend the time, if you know you're going through this process, go download that packet and start filling it out ahead of time. Have it ready to go. Start doing the research on those addresses. Start doing the research on those names, those jobs, all those kinds of things. And then keep that copy of it, because if you're smart, you're going to be applying to more than one agency. And when you do apply to more than one agency, if you already have that stuff written down, it's just a question of transferring it from one to the other. And more importantly, everything will be the same and consistent, rather than screwing up and writing something on one and leaving it off of another. And then when they compare notes, you're disqualified for falsifying your personal history statement.
Right.
And you should be able to get it off any post website. Yes. In California, it's capost.gov, and any other state, it would just be whatever that state is, post.gov.
Yeah. Post.ca.gov. It stands for Peace Officer Standards and Training in California.
Yeah. And you should be able to do it there, like download it and do it on your computer.
Yeah,
that
like
way,
a fillable PDF,
print,
right?
Save. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that exactly. way you don't have to have multiple copies. Whenever you need one, you just hit print and he prints it out for you.
Yep.
And if you need to change something, like, oh shit, I forgot something on there. You just change it. And it's way easier to change it there than it would be to erase everything and rehandwrite it all.
Exactly. And it's much neater and all that kind of stuff. So that's another piece of advice. But ultimately, it depends on what you want to do is Adam. If you want to write tickets, take accidents, be able to transfer anywhere in the state, go to a state trooper or go to a highway patrol. Some state agencies do more police work than others. In California, you know, highway patrol's primary function is, I mean, the cars, what say, they see keeping California moving, right? Something like that.
No, it's safety and service.
Safety and service. There we go.
But
a lot of traffic stuff, right? It's a lot of traffic enforcement, a lot of accidents, a lot of tickets, a lot of DUIs. So if that's really what you're into, then
And again, we're the vehicle theft coordinator for the state. We're right. The drug recognition for the state. I mean, we have horses, we have bicycles, we have the SWAT team.
Airplanes, helicopters,
motorcycles. I mean, there's a lot. And felony, I mean, we're one of the top leaders in felony arrests. I mean, we get out there and do it. I mean, the old reputation of, you know, AAA with a gun. I mean, we're so beyond that and everything that's, you know, that we've been doing. That I always tell them, hey, my very last day on the job, they're ready to drive me home. Because I'm leaving the state car in Fresno. I ran the subway without getting into the whole story. I ended up getting in pursuit of a stolen car on my very last day as a chief. We get the car, we do all that.
Right? He is a ship magnet.
I went back to the office, dropped my car off, and they drove me home. That was the last thing I did on the highway patrol. So
it's pretty epic.
We do get into a lot of stuff. And like I said, the one thing is we talk about each other's agencies, but all agencies really have some good reasons to them. And if you go to a city police, make sure you're also looking as advice, make sure that financially, if you have the choice, pick a department that's financially set, you know,
yes. And
things are set about sure. LAPD. I actually put in for LAPD because the only bad thing is, with a city police is you're there, you know, you stay, you can always lateral to other agencies, but I've always had a respect for LAPD just because, you know what, one, they're badass. Two, they do get great training. They really do. I mean, other than the people that are negative, they do in the law enforcement world, they really do have a great reputation. And the stuff you're going to get, like I work Central LA graveyards. You get involved in more stuff in a short time than many police officers will go their whole career when you're in LA.
It
can be good and can be bad. And then again, with the highway patrol, you want to work the beach, you work the beach. You get bored, you want to live in the mountains, you live in the mountains. Wherever you want to do, that's the beauty of a state agency is you get to move around. And when you're ready to move and get out of this, when you're young, you like working the city and the high crime. And I mean, I couldn't wait to get to work every night in Central LA, the shootings, pursuits, fights. I couldn't wait to get there. It was so much fun, you know, and as you get older, most people, as they get older, they're thinking, maybe I'd like to live up in the mountains and you transfer to the mountains and still making the same amount of money. Right.
And if you want to work Mayberry, you just go find a small town, small department, and you're going to know everybody and you're going to, Oh, Officer Tom, how are you? Da, 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 da. Those are all available to you. So it's really, I think the key was what you said, Brian, which is go do some ride-alongs.
Yeah.
Right. And for Adam, he'll probably listen to this, you know, sitting in his chair up there in Alaska, staring at his computer screen.
Maybe doing PT on the treadmill.
Or on the treadmill, yeah. I think now they wheel their chair up to the treadmill and then just move their feet on the treadmill.
They put the chair on the treadmill and hold the rails and move their feet.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Right.
That's my kind of workout.
Do your research, man. Go and do on the ride-alongs. Go do municipal PD. Maybe try two different cities that you're looking at, because don't just apply to one agency. Apply to 6, 7, 8. It apply as many as you can.
Take the first badge that you're offered.
Mm-hmm. And then go wherever you want. But exactly. Do your research first. Go on the ride-alongs. Go on the state, the county ride-alongs, the sheriff's department. Go on the trooper ride-alongs and see what you want to do. And then maybe pick the brain, which you should be doing in the car, of the officer or supervisor, because some municipal agencies, you know, in California don't allow you to take someone out on a ride-along. The supervisor has to. So it might be true for other agencies in the – yeah. Well, some of our supervisors, you know, actually like to follow the officers around and get involved in stuff. And then some are just like, well, we're just going to wait until we respond to a call. And that's not beneficial. Yeah.
I call them base coaches. They're wearing the, they're on the field and they're wearing the uniform, but they're not actually playing the sport.
Right. It, when, you know, there's something like that, but you know, some of that's good, but when you're doing a ride along, you got to get that person out there to, to, and be involved and see, and see the life of a police officer, because then they can't make their decision. Yeah. So just go and do your ride alongs, research the agency. You know, if you want to work for a small agency or a larger agency, and then if you can pick the brains of a couple officers that are there, or sheriffs, or you know, stateies, and see how they like it, and then see, you know, what they wish they would have done, if they, if anything, and then make your informed decision from there. We can't tell you which agency to choose, because we're probably all a little bit biased. I mean, but I could tell you, do what's best for you. Make sure you make a clear and concise and informed decision, because at the end of the day, it's your life.
Yes, right.
Figure it out. Well, also, one quick question.
Oh, go ahead.
For Brian, why is it that CHP writes or arrests only drunk females for DUIs? And they're always really good looking. I don't get it.
Listen, they're only your friends that do that.
Every time I go to the jail, I always see like six females lined up, and I'm like, oh, CHP must be here. And then I walk further in, and I'm like, oh, there's CHP.
Yeah, do you know why? Because you're always at the women's jail when you see that.
You know, it's funny.
Our jails are just so big, they're co-ed.
So if you look at CHP cars and you look at LAPD cars, CHP has two white doors. The driver's front driver's door and the front passenger's door are white, and the back doors are black. And the LAPD cars are, you know, the orcas, the big white whales with the four white doors, right? That's the,
well, CHP has to know what doors to get into.
Well, that, okay. So my old man used to tell me that it was so that when a CHP officer gets out of his car and starts to get shot at, he'll know which door to jump into.
Yeah. You know what? And the funny part about that is when I worked in LA, sometimes I'd get confused and get in the back seat of their car. Right?
Well, lastly, we had Lindsay, Lynn's on, she was the nurse, and she sent us, she promised she wouldn't, she did. She sent us resources you can go to for addiction. If you were, know somebody who's struggling, she said you can always go to www.aa.org for Alcoholics Anonymous, www.na.org for, Narcotics Anonymous, and then SAMHSA, which is a national, SAMHSA.gov, S-A-M, Sam Adam Mary Henry Sam Adam, SAMHSA.gov, and they have a national helpline section. Or if you have insurance, you can actually call your insurance and find out about any sort of counseling or addiction specialists they have. And you can always just Google rehabs near me if you're really hard up. But ultimately, you know, like we talked about here, like we talked about with Lynn's, call somebody, talk to somebody, because this shit's gonna build up on you. And you know, these experiences we were talking about sharing with your family, it's gonna happen. It's gonna spill out into your home life. The question is, do you want to have it spill out in controlled doses that you can actually manage, or do you want to just come home one day and accidentally dump it all on your family and ruin them? So knowing it's going to happen is a huge asset, and then deciding how you're going to deal with it is a huge asset.
And sometimes, and you know, it might happen at bad times, but knowing and being okay with it, being able to accept it and being able to help control it, because you know what's happening at that point in time, you can kind of control it and just be okay with it. But at the same time, get it out there, get it out prior. That way your kids don't see you break down. That way your family doesn't see you break down.
Right.
And, you know, and it's okay if they do. It's normal. It's the shit that we're going through and the shit that these people are going through. It's not normal.
No.
And it's going to happen, and just be okay with it.
And if your kids do see you break down, but it's in a controlled manner, that's so much more important than having them see you fall apart, which is totally different.
Well, there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah. And also with alcohol abuse, you know, most agencies have help for you as long as you go to them first.
Right.
Or you have other addictions. If you go to them first, it's better, you know, to get the help, let them know you have an issue with it. They'll help you with it. But if you do something, you know, first, well, now it's not as easy to make a wreck. And you
like,
know what?
Like crash this, your personal vehicle.
Right. And listening to this, you know, this thing that you're doing today, you know, do it now. Don't say, yeah, that's something I need to do. Yeah, I know I have to drink every night and all that. Do something about it now. Don't wait. Just make it happen now. Right. You know, and you can turn your life around and actually be happy again. And so many people have done it. And that's what you need to realize, that people have done it and they've been successful and wish they would have done it a lot sooner. So take the advice that's being given.
Yep. Well, Brian, we usually allow our guests to dedicate their episode, because we like to dedicate our episodes to our brothers and sisters and fallen comrades who have either died as a result of the job or died in the line of duty. So it's up to you. If you have somebody you want to dedicate this episode to, we like to give our guests the chance to do that first.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'll tell you, there have been so many that, you know, as soon as you hang up and you're thinking, wow, I wish I would have said this and this. But just recent pain is just, we just lost one of our staff from clerical, Patricia Medina, who just passed 3 days ago. From Bakersfield and Templeton CHP. Fred Oaks, who I've been very close with and for the last year, just really fighting, with cancer, a Boston Bruins fan, and me being a Philadelphia Flyers fan, you know, we've had plenty of arguments and stuff, but
Legion of Doom, baby. Philly's my East Coast team.
Yeah, that's my hometown, baby. So
LA Kings are my homer team, but if I have to root for an East Coast team, it's the Flyers, because Eric Lindros was my boy.
Oh yeah, yeah. And so, you know, and there's others, Ben and stuff, but I appreciate that. And we're gonna have to go to a Kings game. You know, we do Guns and Hoses every year, Cops Against Firemen, and I'm the captain of the Cops team, so
we'll come out for that too. Well, until then, on that note, rest easy. We've got it from here. And for the rest of you, come home with your shield or on it.